Good afternoon. Are council ready? I'd like to begin by apologizing for the delay, but we just finished an en banc hearing and had a lot to discuss and got carried away. But I hope you'll forgive us, and we're ready to begin now.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Kevin Girk on behalf of the appellants, Dr. Jay Hildreth, and his family. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The appeal of this case is from the Chancery Court's decision in my client's appraisal action and equitable challenge to the merger consideration paid to the common shareholders as a result of the merger between Castle Dental Centers, Inc. into a wholly owned subsidiary of Bright Now Dental, Inc. The core issue in this case is whether Castle could base the fair value of its common stock on 200 million more shares than its certificate of incorporation authorized. That certificate of incorporation authorized 18 million shares of common stock, 1 million shares of preferred stock, and 1 million shares of Class B common stock. Within a one-year period, Castle sold two newly created series of preferred stock, Series A and Series B, to investors purportedly based on a blank check provision in its charter. In July of 2002, and again in May of 2003, Castle filed certificates of designation for the Series A and B preferred shares. Both series gave the holders of the preferred shares rights to convert their shares into shares of Castle common stock. When exercised, the Series B converted into 38.7 million shares of common stock, and the Series A converted into 165 million shares of Castle common stock. Because that far exceeded the limits in Castle's charter, far exceeded the authorized limits of its common stock, Castle was required to amend and did attempt to amend. In January and again in July of 2003, Castle twice attempted to amend its charter to increase the total number of authorized shares from 18 million common shares to 100 million common shares, and then again from 100 million shares of common stock to 250 million shares of common stock.
It seems to be undisputed that number of authorized shares of common stock never exceeded 18 million when all is said and done, correct?
The
actual number of authorized shares stayed at 18 million despite two efforts that failed to amend the charter to increase the number of authorized common shares.
It's undisputed that at the time of the merger, there were only 18 million shares of common stock available according to Castle's charter.
All right. The response, or one of the responses, appears to be, well, that doesn't really matter because this, under this merger agreement, the price was predicated upon a larger number of common shares because merger, you know, the number of shares over which the consideration was going to be spread was done on an as-if converted basis, and the certificate of designations and preferences for all of the preferred shares and the warrants permitted an as-if conversion basis for a merger. That's the other side's position, is it not?
That is correct,
Okay. What is your response to the argument that the certificate of designations permitted, at least in case of a merger, an as-if or quasi-conversion?
First of all, Your Honor, I believe that provision of the charter would be unenforceable and invalid because it contradicts – I'm sorry, that provision of the certificate of designation would be invalid because it contradicts the clear limits of the charter. And also contradicts Section 151.
Well, the certificate of designations is in the charter, is part of the charter, is it not?
It is. If it's properly filed, yes, it becomes part of the charter as an amendment, Your Honor. However, I'm not so sure that the language of the certificates of designation specifically state that the conversion on an as-if converted basis is permitted despite an authorized share failure. There are specific provisions in the certificate of designation that states that in – let me backtrack, Your Honor. The certificate of designation requires that if there's ever an authorized share failure, not enough common stock to support a conversion of the preferred stock, CASA was required to take immediate action to correct that that share failure through an amendment. There are specific provisions in that certificate of designation that state in case there is an issue over the vote, the preferred shareholders would be allowed to vote as on an as-if-converted basis despite the authorized share failure. That is the language
of it. What about in the case of a merger? What does the certificate of designations or certificates of designations provide?
It's nowhere near as explicit, Your Honor. It states that essentially in a merger situation, one of the remedies that the shareholders are entitled to is to get what they would have gotten according to the certificate of designation. But it does not specifically say that in the case of an authorized share failure, that it would be entitled to receive what it received. That's different from the provision in the certificate of designation regarding the right to vote.
So you're
very
saying
explicit.
So in the case of a voting rights, there is an express as if converted feature.
Yes.
But not in the case of a merger.
Yes.
And let me follow up on that for a moment. What if the merger agreement said that the preferred stockholders will be paid, and I'm not good at math, so you know, figure out the number that would equate to the as if converted. So although the language was as if converted, if instead it said everybody else is going to get 15 cents a share, the preferred stock is going to get $15 a share, or whatever the numbers may be. Would there be any problem with that?
In the hypothetical, it's possible that there wouldn't be a problem. For instance, if there was a specific payout or a liquidation preference or something like that, but that's not how this...
No, but if I understand correctly, your client has acknowledged that there's no overreaching here, there's no breach of fiduciary duty claims, there's nothing of that nature about the setting of the price and so forth, correct?
Correct. We don't dispute that the amount paid, $56.1 million, that right now paid for CASL was not a fair price. We are arguing that the apportionment of that $56.1 million.
Right. But what I'm saying is that you're not arguing that the apportionment was in error based upon some breach of fiduciary duty or overreaching with respect to the different classes of stock, are you?
We did not bring that claim, Your Honor.
Okay. So what I'm trying to get at is that although the merger agreement talked in terms of as if converted, wasn't that in some respects, or wasn't that the equivalent, wasn't that a kind of a shorthand for saying, preferred stockholders, you're getting X per share. Common stockholders, you're getting Y per share. Isn't that really what happened here?
Your Honor, I believe what happened is that they were all grouped together and they were all paid an equal amount based on the total authorized share of common stock, which when the merger agreement was put together, I don't think this issue had arisen yet. And they were assuming that they had 250 million authorized shares. I will say that there were probably other ways to do this merger that would have been in compliance with the law, but that didn't happen in this case.
Well, in connection with the merger, was there a separate? The proxies were solicited, isn't that correct? Was a proxy statement, or was there not?
I believe there was, Your Honor.
Were proxies solicited only in connection with voting the merger up or down, or was there a separate box to for amending the charter to increase the authorized common?
I misspoke, Your Honor. I'm sorry. It was not a proxy. It was approved by an action by written consent of the Series B preferred shareholders.
All right.
So it's into a separate
issue. The vote approving the merger did not include any action by the common shareholders that could be construed as an amendment of the charter to increase the authorized common shares.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And Justice Berger, back on your point, the separate provisions in the certificate of designation for the authorized share failure in the voting instance and then also with the right to participate in the merger, as I stated, the voting provision was specific and the ability to share in the merger consideration was not. And I think because of the preferred shareholders have to be construed strictly and nothing can be implied in their favor, they cannot rely on that provision to authorize this transaction.
Let me ask you a different question. If you were to prevail, this is in the context of an appraisal action, correct?
Yes, and also
my concern is this. If I understood the trial court correctly, the trial court was saying that I'm going to appraise the shares as if there were the larger number of shares out there, and here's how much the petitioners are going to get per share, right?
Correct.
And part of what I understood the trial court's reasoning to be was if we back this all up, there would be rescission with respect to the issuance of the preferred stock and an undoing that would leave your clients with perhaps even less than what they got under this scenario, because it would mean that the holders of the preferred stock hadn't gotten what they paid for. And what is your response to that thinking? You know, what's wrong with the trial court's analysis at that level?
I think it goes against the triplex case, Your Honor, where if there's invalid stock, you are not entitled to damages based on that invalid stock. At most, you would be entitled to rescission or cancellation, get your money back, and also use the illegality of that.
Right, but didn't the trial court say they would be entitled to rescission, the preferred stockholders?
The trial court said that there would be potent claims that the Series B and Series A would have if this transaction did not go through according to the merger document.
Okay, and if that's the case, what I'm trying to find out is what does your client accomplish by winning on this claim if ultimately that means that everything gets unwound or rescinded and your client still gets the same, in your client's perspective, small amount of consideration?
Well, no one's asking, and the Series B and the Series A will not be required to return any money. So they wouldn't have a damages claim. So in reality, that won't happen. The preferred shareholders are not a part of this action, and the contract argument should not be able to overcome the specific limits in the charter.
That wasn't my question. My question was, why would your clients be any better off? Why are you pursuing this if the alternative, if you're correct, is that everything gets rescinded and your clients wind up in the same condition anyhow?
Because if it's unwound, Your Honor, there would be 18 million shares, and the way the merger was set up, the payout was based on the number of shares, and it would increase my client's percentage of payout from 0.12% all the way up to 1.5%.
But I think the question was, if there's a rescission of the merger, there is no payout. That is, if there's a rescission, everybody gets their stock back, and you start from square one.
Yes, Your Honor. Our position is that won't happen in this case because it's an appraisal action, and the preferred shareholders are not a party. And in reality, the merger transaction won't have to be rescinded.
Because no one's asked for it.
Yeah, you're right, Your Honor. So what we're asking for is a percentage of the Castle Common stock is going.
An adjustment of the merger, of the total merger price into a reallocation, correct?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
You're asking for a reallocation of the merger consideration.
Yes, Your Honor.
With the result that the common shareholders would get a lot more than 15 cents.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can that be done in an appraisal where the issue is not the fair value of the company, but simply the proper number of shares that are being, that are participating in the merger?
I believe so, Your Honor. The appraisal statute, Section 262, does not preclude this issue from being presented. The trial court's required to base fair value of the stock on a proportionate pro rata basis on the interest of Castle as a going concern, including all relevant factors. I think all relevant factors would include invalid stock, violation of the common shareholder's right to participate in the class.
You may think that, but is there any case that says that?
I cited two cases in my brief, Your Honor, standing for the general proposition that the shareholder is entitled to his pro rata proportionate interest in the merger consideration in the company as a going concern, but not specifically stating that this specific claim has been found to be within the 262 statute, Your Honor.
You're into your rebuttal time, which you're welcome to use, or you can save what remains.
I will make one more statement, Your Honor, and keep the same. In closing, Your Honor, we ask that this transaction not stand. If it does, it will open the door for future shareholder abuses where a private contract right can overcome the specific language of the charter and also the corporate statute. It would also allow a company to effectively amend its charter without the proper class vote, and it would potentially render Section 151 and Section 242 meaningless. Therefore, Your Honor, we respectfully request that you grant a relief. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. John Hendershot of Richards, Leighton & Finger for the respondent below and appellee, Castle Dental Centers, Inc. As the court discussed with Mr. Girk, this case is before the court on appeal from a post-trial decision by Vice Chancellor Strine. The parties stipulated below that right now the arm's-length acquirer paid a fair price for the equity of Castle on an aggregate basis, and the petitioners expressly waived any claim that the board of Castle acted in bad faith or breached its fiduciary duties in connection with the merger. As the Vice Chancellor correctly held, that stipulation left the petitioners able to argue only that as a pure matter of law without regard to anybody's intent or motivations or any mitigating factual circumstances whatever, the Castle Board could not have allocated the merger consideration in the way it did. And I think there are two principal reasons why the Vice Chancellor was right to hold that the petitioners had not made that showing. First is the one that was discussed here at the beginning of Mr. Girk's presentation. The company had valid and binding contracts with its preferred shareholders, which obligated, quite clearly, the company in the event of a cash-out merger to allow the preferred stockholders to share in the cash merger consideration on an as-if-converted basis, even if a sufficient number of shares were not available to allow an actual conversion.
And doesn't this open the door to potential mischief, major mischief?
Certainly a transaction like this is potentially and in principle subject to a fiduciary duty challenge. The petitioners expressly waived that. That was an unusual course of action for them to take. The Vice Chancellor told them it was before they did it. In the ordinary case, there wouldn't be such a waiver. There wouldn't be such a stipulation, and a fiduciary duty claim could be brought. It's waived here.
Okay. Well, your contention is that there are clear contract rights entitled your clients to proceed the way they did.
That's correct.
And putting aside any considerations of fiduciary duty, what are the clear contract rights? Where are they located?
They're located in the certificates of designation for the Series A and Series B shares.
Where?
In the Series A designations, Section 3A and Section 12, it's on pages A87, 88, and 92. And with respect to the Series B shares, Section 4E and Section 9 on pages A105 and A110, respectively.
And where does the as-if entitlement, as-if converted entitlement appear in those sections?
To take just the Series B, which is on page A105, because it's exemplary of the A as well. The certificate of designation says that prior to the consummation of any organic change, which is a defined term that includes mergers, the company shall make appropriate provisions to ensure that each of the holders of Series B preferred stock shall thereafter have the right to acquire and receive, in lieu of or in addition to, as the case may be, the shares of common stock immediately theretofore acquirable and receivable upon the conversion of such holders' Series B preferred stock, such shares of stock, securities, or assets, cash is an asset, as such holder would have received in connection with such organic change if such holder had converted its Series B preferred stock immediately prior to such organic change. Reading that in pari materia with Section 9 of the same certificate of designation, amounts, which this is about the third or fourth sentence in
doesn't,
that section.
Doesn't that construction at least, can it be read to require that a conversion of preferred into common be legally possible?
If that were the only provision in the certificate of designation relevant to the issue, I think it could.
Okay.
However, if you read it in pari materia with the third or fourth sentence of Section 9, which provides as follows, amounts set forth.
Wait, what page is that?
Page A110, Justice Berger.
Okay. All right.
And it's in the middle of paragraph 9. It's about the third sentence or so.
Okay.
Amounts set forth or provided for herein with respect to payments, conversion, and the like, and the computation thereof, shall be the amounts to be received by the holder thereof, and shall not, except as expressly provided herein, be subject to any other obligation of the company or the performance thereof. One of the obligations of the company was a customary covenant to keep authorized and in reserve for issuance a sufficient number of common shares to allow the conversion to happen anytime the Series B holders wanted it to.
Do you think that language would give clear notice to anyone reading the certificate of designation that basically you could have an as-if conversion and a merger even though there was an authorized share failure?
I think it does, Your Honor.
Where does it – how does it do that? I mean, it's very broad, vague language. Let me put it differently. As your colleague on the other side of the bar argued, and I think correctly, the certificate of designations is explicitly clear about as if converted on the as if converted feature in the case of a shareholder vote. And one would argue from that, I suppose, that it would be equally easy to have drafted comparable language in the case of a merger, but it doesn't.
Well,
it doesn't say that.
It doesn't say that specifically because the paragraph relating to the treatment of preferred shareholders in the event of an organic change is a very general paragraph. There are lots of things that are an organic change. A sale of substantially all assets is an organic change. A merger is an organic change. A recapitalization of the corporation is an organic change. It's a very general provision, and this Section 9, the sentence in Section 9 that I've just read, covers the entire field of the definition of organic change. With respect to the vote, that's a very discrete issue. There are specific provisions saying this is how many votes each share of preferred stock gets, and there's no amount set forth to be amount set forth or provided with respect to payments and the like.
All that may be true, but the question that I'm asking is it clear from for whatever reason or lack thereof that in the case of an organic change, which happens to be a merger, there can be an as-if conversion, or do we have a provision that can be read either way?
I think it is clearly the case that this certificate of designation protects the preferred stockholders in the event of an authorized share failure and in the event of an organic change occurring while an authorized share failure is going on.
Suppose we were to disagree with that and find that it isn't clear.
Okay.
What then?
Well, then I think you would come to the second argument that the Vice Chancellor properly relied on, in my view, which is that even if you assume that the company, for whatever reason, was not bound by the contract it made with the preferred stockholders, it still had to pay the preferred stockholders something. It took their money in 2002 and 2003. There's no challenge to the two transactions in 2002 and 2003 by which it did so. In fact, the petitioners didn't even own stock at the time, and they don't own stock anymore, so any derivative claim would be barred. It's very unclear to me that there would be any direct.
So you're going for, give me a in a sentence what it is that you claim the court held, the second reason.
The second reason is that if the company were not bound by its certificate of designations, the board of directors nevertheless had to make a decision about how to allocate the merger consideration as among its common and preferred stockholders. If the certificates of designation didn't control the board's discretion in doing so, then the board had to make a decision. The petitioners here have waived any claim that the board, in making that decision, in entering into this merger agreement, breached a fiduciary duty or acted in bad faith.
Well, we're not talking about breach of fiduciary duty or bad faith, though. If the certificate of designations, at least that portion of it that concerns mergers, does not clearly authorize an as-if conversion, then basically the shares against which or through which the merger consideration is to be spread would be limited by the actual number of shares outstanding, would it not?
I'm not sure I follow your question, Your Honor.
Well, there would be a different allocation, and that allocation, one of the facts that could not be altered in making that allocation would be that there are 18 million common shares.
Right, followed by substantial litigation by the preferred holders who specifically bargained for protection. They got the corporation to agree, we will keep a sufficient number of common shares authorized and in reserve to allow us to fulfill our obligation to let you convert your preferred shares.
So they would get the, what in your view is the agreed upon consideration, ultimately as damages anyway.
Well, that's one way to measure damages, and that is one thing we presented to the trial court. The other way to measure damages is if these preferred shares are completely void and you have to go back and rescind the 2002 and 2003 recapitalization transactions whereby they came into being and whereby the preferred investors bought 97% of the equity of this company, then you have a massive food fight on your hands, as the Vice Chancellor rightly characterized it. And it's quite possible.
Who's contending they're void?
The petitioners did in their brief.
Well, if you, if the number of authorized shares is limited, at least in the case of common stock, to 18 million, then the vote, isn't it the case that the vote that was cast in favor of the merger would not be effective? That is, wouldn't the merger fall by the wayside as a legal matter, and the parties are left wherever they would have been before the merger was commenced?
Well, I think that's an interesting question, Justice Jacobs. The Series B holders had the right to convert their shares in part. They didn't have to convert all at once. The number of shares outstanding, of common shares outstanding, was somewhat less than 9 million. It was 8.7 million, I believe.
Okay.
If the Series B preferred shareholders had converted approximately 4,000 of their Series B shares, they had 170,000 of them, into common stock, they would have had slightly more than 9 million common shares. They could have controlled the vote of the class vote with respect to any charter amendment. And in addition, as I think you and Mr. Girk have discussed, the voting rights of the Series B preferred holders are independent of whether a conversion can happen. There's a very explicit provision in the Series B designation. There's a comparable one in the A designation.
Okay, so they could have amended the charter.
Well, they could have approved the merger,
they could have
without,
approved
approving,
the merger.
Without approving a charter amendment.
Okay, but they didn't. I mean, it didn't happen that way.
Well, they did approve the merger without approving a charter amendment. They did do that.
Okay.
And that, I take it that's a perfectly legitimate thing for them to do without amending the charter first.
Let me make sure I understand your position. You're arguing that they could have approved the merger with a lot fewer votes than what they actually purported to exercise. The preferred, that is.
Well, I'm saying that the preferred's voting powers explicitly under the terms of the certificate of designation, and I think Mr. Girk said this, are not dependent on the authorized number of common shares available. The preferred were entitled to cast 200 million votes even if there were only 18 million common shares available for a conversion. So the legality of the approval of the merger is not subject to the problem of an authorized share failure.
Okay, so there wouldn't be a rescission of the merger? Is that what you're saying? The merger would still stand, or at least the vote approving it would stand?
I would think so, Your Honor, yes.
Okay, then what would be the consequence were we to hold that there is no as if conversion in terms of the merger itself?
Well, I think a lot of corporations would think that you've undercut the solidity of anti-destruction provisions in their certificates of designation.
Well, whatever they would think, you know, if we find in this case that there was no, the only way that you could have a conversion would be to have a real conversion and there weren't enough authorized shares, what's the consequence?
Well, the consequence is, the immediate consequence would be potentially you would remand it to the Court of Chancery for entry of a judgment in favor of the petitioners. However, on a going forward basis, I think.
Well, wait a second. I don't mean to interrupt your answer, but before I get even more confused, I thought this is an appraisal action.
It is, Your Honor.
So we only care about how many authorized shares there are or how many shares are outstanding for purposes of dividing up the total value of the company to see how much you're entitled to in an appraisal, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if there are 250 million shares out there because we treat the preferred as if they've been converted, then you have one number per share, right? A small number that's value of the
preferred shares have value too, Your Honor.
No, I haven't gotten there.
Okay.
What I'm saying is that if we treat the company as if it had the 250 million shares, even though it didn't, then if the company is worth $100 million, you do the division and you come up with how much each share is worth. And then you multiply it by the number of shares the petitioners own, and that's how much they're entitled to in an appraisal, correct?
If you treat the preferred shares solely as things that may be converted into common and had to be converted into common
right.
before the merger happened.
Right.
That's correct.
Right. Okay.
I don't think that's the correct way to do it.
Okay, but wait a second. Now let's assume that the preferred shares couldn't be treated as if they were converted into the millions and millions of common shares because the certificate didn't authorize that many shares to exist, right?
Right.
But we're dealing with an appraisal, and the preferred shares are still out there and get a portion of what the total value of the company is when you're determining how much the plaintiffs are entitled to as stockholders, right?
Yes.
So don't you get to the same number whichever way you do it?
That is certainly an argument we presented to the Vice Chancellor. His view doesn't exclude that point of view, certainly, and that's an independently sufficient basis on which you can affirm his conclusion, certainly.
Okay.
I think we've gone past discussing whether the conversion features of this preferred security were unlawful in themselves. I don't think they were. I think what we've gotten down to was whether the preferred shares. Let me back up here.
Well, in terms of the conversion feature, in this context, was it anything more than a basis to determine the value of the preferred shares?
Well, there were, in principle, the preferred stockholders could have converted some of their shares. I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, strictly. Your position is that this right to conversion and determines the value of the shares for purposes of this organic change?
Well, it's used in the calculation of the value to which the preferred shareholders are entitled in the event of an organic change. It's used solely as a calculation. There's no actual conversion of the shares here. The merger agreement provides that the preferred shares are to be converted into a right to receive a specified amount in cash. It's not a case where the preferred shares are first converted into common to the extent that's legally possible, and then the common shares thus created are converted into the merger consideration or the right to receive merger consideration.
So it is just a designation of value as opposed to an actual step of conversion.
As the merger agreement in this case was structured, that's correct. And I think that also goes back to something Mr. Girk said. There are a number of ways you can skin a cat or conduct a merger. what happened here was the lawyers got together, figured out they had this problem of an authorized share failure because somebody gave the corporation bad advice 2 years ago, and they figured out how to construct a merger agreement so that it wasn't a problem. Now, I would note that the petitioners did argue in their briefing that the shares were void in themselves. They argued that at trial. I'm not sure they still agree with that. I think it's quite clear that the shares here were not void. Castle did follow the roadmap that's laid out in the statute. The board did adopt a resolution. The board did file a certificate of designation.
When you say shares, you mean preferred shares?
The preferred shares, that's correct. So I take it there's no real question that the shares were actually void. If they were, however, then, as the Vice Chancellor noted, the remedy for issuance of void stock is cancellation. Justice Ridgely alluded to a damage remedy that the preferred stockholders might have had if the corporation had told them, look, sorry, we're not going to give you what you contracted for because we failed in our obligation to keep a sufficient number of shares authorized and in reserve to allow you to convert. Had they done that, there's one damage remedy that gets you to exactly the same place. If you take a different measure of damages and go back and rescind the 2002 and 2003 investment transactions, the record doesn't say exactly where the petitioners end up, but I suspect that they would have ended up in a worse place. I believe the petitioners admitted at trial that just in the Series B refinancing in 2003, Castle got over $20 million of new value. That's something that would have had to have been paid back. The board of directors had to, in the context of doing this merger, to the extent there was any doubt about what the preferred holders were entitled to, had to deal with the potential liability to the preferred holders if the company didn't give the preferred holders what it contracted for solely because the corporation failed in its obligation to keep a sufficient number of common shares available. And the board had to make a decision about that. It, to the extent it thought about it, that's a business judgment that hasn't been challenged here.
Factual question.
Yes, sir.
What was the total amount of the merger consideration?
Total amount of the merger consideration was about $56 million. The first $19 million or so was to pay off pre-existing debts of the corporation. The remaining $34 million approximately was divided among the stockholders. Unless the court has any further questions, I have nothing this time.
Thank you.
Your Honors, there are two issues that illustrate the potential problems if you treat, if you allow Castle to treat this merger and the vote as if there were actually 250 million shares available. First is the issue of the written consents to approve the merger.
Wait a second. You're not challenging the merger, are you? You're seeking appraisal.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So why are we concerned with what the implications would be for the merger?
The potential issues that may arise down the road, Your Honor, for other corporations will be presented with the same issue.
Well, what we're trying to decide is whether the trial court correctly valued your shares, right?
That's correct.
So the merger's done. It's not being challenged. The question is, how much was this company worth as a going concern, and what's your proportionate share in that company, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And tell me why it makes any difference whether the court does the math by saying there are 250 million shares outstanding and your clients have 100,000 of them or whatever number versus there are 9 million shares outstanding and your client has the same 9 million shares of common outstanding, your client has the same 100,000, but there are also now two preferred stockholders who also have a significant portion of the equity in the company. Why does it matter how it gets apportioned? Won't you come to the same result?
Yes, Your Honor.
You will come to the same result, or you won't?
In relation to the written consent issue that I was speaking about, Your Honor?
No, in terms of appraisal.
I'm sorry, I didn't follow the question.
Okay. Your clients are entitled to a share of the value of the company as a going concern. That's what appraisal is about, right?
Correct.
You have to determine what the total value of the company is, and then you have to take what your client's interest is and see what portion of the total, what fraction that represents, and then you do the math, right?
Correct.
Does it matter whether the math is done based upon an assumption that all the preferred are converted to the full amount that they could have been converted to if there were enough authorized shares? In other words, we get to the 250 million shares and say you represent 0.01% of the 250 million, or if instead we say, okay, there were only 9 million shares that actually were outstanding of common, you have 10% of that, but there also was preferred stock outstanding, and it represented 90% of the total value of the company. Wouldn't you get to the same number at the end of the day?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because the preferred shareholders made huge profits on this deal, and under the case law, they would, in a rescission or cancellation, they would not be entitled to those huge profits. They would get a return of what they paid, according to the Triplex case.
But we're not talking about rescinding anything. We're talking about your proportionate value of the company. All right. I think I'm not making myself clear enough, and the time has expired, so thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
We'll take this matter under advisement and stand in recess.